Welcome to the after party. It's time to change. You're just getting started. You can teach an old dog new ways, and not just on Saturday. Hello, children and adults. I hope you're not a child and you're listening to this. This is After Party Pod with Anna David. Look, if you're a child, I'm totally down with you listening to this with a parent present. It really depends on what I mean by a child. I don't know. I have no idea. People often ask me, is Party Girl, can my child read it? Or a newcomer addict asks that, and I say sponsees have to wait 6 months and children should be 18, which means they're not a child technically anymore. Anyway, hi. This is After Party Pod. If you're new to the podcast, welcome. Glad you're here. Hope you will join the after party every week. This was the tagline for the site when I first started it, and I haven't used it in about a year. What was it? We had several. The after party where you don't have to be on the list, where to go when the party's over. What I mean by the site, I mean After Party Chat, which is the site that that has articles, 5 new articles every day about addiction recovery. We have interviews, we have essays, we have news posts, we have lots of lists. We're funny. We try to make it funny. And After Party Pod is a part of that. It is a podcast that goes up on the site every Thursday night. And it is also available on iTunes and Stitcher and SoundCloud and however you happen to get it so that you're listening right now. What else? Things are good. I had a great weekend. I have learned to have a weekend. That's weird. I used to not be able to differentiate between weeks and weekends. It was all just sort of work. And then I made a major effort to not work. And now it's sort of happening naturally. I just sort of, I don't know, I go and I do something on a Friday night. And then I'm Saturday, I go and I'm doing something. And maybe there's a little bit of work because this site is a lot of work. And then I'm doing something Saturday night and Sunday. I'm sure you guys are familiar with this. It's a little bit new to me. What else? Oh, Danielle Stewart, who is one of the contributors, one of the main contributors to the website After Party Chat, and a previous podcast guest, one of the very first ones. She and I are going to start a little video blog, a vlog, as the kids call it, where we are going to be talking about the addiction and recovery news that we are not covering on the site. So that's something to get excited about potentially. She's really one of the funniest people I know. So what else? This podcast is brought to you by Audible. And if you want a free audio book, all you got to do is go to audibletrial.com/afterpartypod. They have over 150,000 titles to choose from. I just downloaded something this weekend. In fact, I went and I bought on Amazon the Kindle version of Lena Dunham's book, Not That Kind of Girl. And then I thought, you know what? That would be actually a really fun book to listen to. It would be fun to read, but not. I find that there are certain books that I can get really into listening to on Audible, and I knew that that would be one of them. And so I returned the Amazon. They let me do it, and then I got the Audible, and it's great. She reads it herself. I'm a huge fan of hers, just so you are perfectly clear about that. Now, well, that brings us to today's guest, Alice Carbone. I actually, right after she left, I texted her and I said, now, is it Carbone? I was spelling it phonetically, Carbone. And she very kindly recorded her voice saying it and texted it to me, but I can't do it the way she can. She's got a great accent. You're about to hear that. And maybe you're listening because you know Alice or you're a fan of Alice. She has a very popular blog and podcast called Coffee with Alice. And she has had fantastic guests on that podcast. Jerry Stahl, Henry Rollins, Bill Pullman, Moby, Mark Maron. Did I say that one already? She, and Janet Fitch, and she's really gutsy and goes out and gets these people to do her podcast. And she's also a writer. She is a regular contributor to After Party Chat. And she has her debut novel coming out May of next year from Rare Bird Books. And so it was exciting to get her on the podcast. Just because I love also when it can be somebody who you might be familiar with her writing already from the site. And she's got a really interesting story that I did not know. I mean, I knew there was darkness because she's written, you know, about a lot of those issues for the site. But we got into some new territory for me. And she was really forthcoming, and I appreciate that. And it just became a really lovely chat about going from dark to light and what that really means. So I hope you enjoy this. I hope if you do, you will be kind enough to leave a 5-star review on iTunes and subscribe, because it really means a lifelong devotion from me to you, which I hope is worth something. And it just helps other people find the podcast. So here we go. Alice Carbone.
I first started taking drugs by chewing blocks of hash.
Oh my God. I think my copy has like blood stains on it from shooting up while reading it.
Party animal. I hate to say that because that makes me sound Paris Hilton-y. I was on the, as right. I call it, the Autobahn to nowhere.
I'm very lucky, because would you have wanted to have a celebrity junkie for a dad?
You don't keep it? I don't know.
Like a normal.
Yeah, I just told you how tech savvy I am. But look, it's working. Alice, I'm so glad you're here.
Thank you for asking me. You were my first interview, live interview, and now this is my very first podcast. I was freaking out this morning.
Oh, are you freaking out now? Are you calmer? There's nothing to be nervous about. You do a podcast.
I know, but I have no right to be nervous. I've never been interviewed before, so you are the first one.
Okay. It's harder to interview people than be interviewed.
Oh, yeah.
And I predict this will be one in a long line of podcast interviews you'll be doing. So we met because we met on Twitter.
Mm-hmm.
A Twitter friendship was born of sorts. Yeah. And then you asked me to do. You asked me to be interviewed
yes.
by you.
Yes.
And it was this morning where I was so tired. I hadn't slept, and then we went to go do it, and then
It was too noisy. So
well, ironically, there was a 12-step meeting going on, and so we left and we went back to my horrible old apartment that I hated so much.
It was too sweet though.
It was horrible.
Well, you were.
I was way over it. Yeah. And I live in a great place now. But anyway, and so then I thought we were doing a podcast.
A podcast.
And you were like, oh, I thought we were doing an interview. Why not just make this a podcast?
And we recorded with the iPhone.
Yeah.
And you really were the first one. And I remember you told me, let's see if you like it, we're going to publish it, otherwise it's just going to be an interview. And
yeah.
You worked great.
Thank you. It was good.
Thank you.
And then I realized that my workout class, my yoga class was starting, and I was like, I'm so sorry. I have to strip naked in front of you. And you handled
it. It's all live.
What?
It's all live.
I know.
You're stripping naked in front of me.
I know.
So we can do this.
We can do this. So this is nothing. And so, because you have a fascinating story. So you're born in Italy.
Mm-hmm. Born and raised.
Born and raised.
Lived there for 27 years.
Uh-huh.
4.5 years ago, I wanted to change my life. I was in a really bad place.
Yeah.
And I don't know how a friend of mine asked me to come here. I was an interpreter and a translator.
Mm-hmm.
And he offered this gig for like 3 days to be an interpreter in Los Angeles.
So he flew you out, or it was
The company. It was an Italian producer.
Mm-hmm.
So I had to be an interpreter here in LA for 3 days.
Mm-hmm.
So I said yes, because it was a little bit of money. Mm-hmm. And I decided that I would stay here 90 days to clean up and decide what to do
with my life. Okay.
I didn't get so. I mean, it took a while before I got clean there, but it changed my life.
So, and had you had ideas about moving to the States before that?
I mean, I always liked it. It's like a dream for Italian. You know, for I'd been here before, but it's very hard. It's very difficult to move here on a regular on a permanent basis.
Why?
So, you know, immigration visa, if you don't have a real reason to be here. And for me, it all worked out because it started as a joke. It started, you know, I'm going to stay here 90 days. And after 90 days, I went back to Italy because my visa expired. And while I was here, a press agency asked me to be a journalist for like a foreign correspondent for the Hollywood Press. So I did that. They gave me a better visa.
So are you in the Hollywood Press Association?
Oh, no, okay. No. It was a, I would do press junkets for this Italian press agency.
Yeah, I've done junkets. It's, you know, what it is.
Well, I mean, it was a, an experience.
Yeah.
But, you know, I stayed here. And then with the blog, everything changed because I got a, you know, I got a better visa and I got a publisher from a book.
So wait, so you started doing the blog?
I started doing the blog right away, like probably 2 weeks, a month after I was here.
And you got a visa from that?
Yeah, I got a visa through the blog because I was interviewing people. And, you know, the blog started as a joke as me. If you read my old stuff, it's like, you know, the drunk writing that you do?
Yeah.
It's angry and depressed and...
Yeah.
Bragging about how much you drink and how much fucked up you are.
Yeah.
And it was more towards, it was more inclined towards poetry. That's what it was.
Right.
And I don't remember. I interviewed somebody and I started to interview people and Leonard Cohen got involved. Like, I wrote a review and of his album and they loved it. His management loved it.
They just saw it or you sent it to them?
I sent it to them. And they invited me to New York.
What?
To meet Leonard.
What?
Yeah, this was in 2012. I was 90 days sober when I met Leonard. Not even 90, probably 60 days sober. And I flew to New York and met him. And I gave him a very rough draft of my book. He read it on the plane.
That is shocking, this turn of events.
And that's how...
Aren't you publishing through Rare Bird?
Yes.
So Tyson.
Yeah, so they, you know... That's a huge lesson that I had to learn on humility, actually.
Why?
Because I thought that my life would change just because.
Oh, yeah.
It kind of did because, you know, it helped my
immigration
situation. It was. But it wasn't the fairy tale that I, you know, I got the publisher through other, you know, by myself. I knew Tyson and. Things didn't really happen the way I was.
No.
You know,
like, I mean, I think that the book, the My Life is Going to Change. Overnight book dream is just a total lie. Like, I do think...
But not even getting a manager. I got one manager for the first time when I it was Leonard's manager. And
Were they a publishing manager?
No, it was just a my business manager. But things didn't... I lived in this fairy tale. Okay, now everything is going to change. No, this is going to change my life. It really hasn't.
Yeah. Yeah,
and I kind of bragged about it because it was, you know, I was getting sober and everything started to go well, and I thought that was my life change moment, you know. And,
totally.
And I had to really pay a huge price in humility because I lost everything after that in sobriety.
Yeah.
And I'm not complaining. I'm great, you know.
Well, you've bounced back. Magnificently.
Yeah, that's, you know, sometimes I think when you know, they say crisis opportunity. For the first time, I really did that. I decided not to, you know, play the self-pity card and the...
Yeah.
And things turned around unexpectedly.
Yeah. I mean, and the thing about you is you're very honest about it. You know what I mean? Like, when I met you, you were very honest about, like, I'm in this dark place. Your writing for the site was you know...
I think I started with one on self-harm.
They were dark. They were great. And then, like, suddenly you snap your fingers and you're like, your Facebook photos aren't, like, dour. You know, you're, like, huge smile. And, like, your pieces are all about, can I share about being happy? You know, it was, like, a radical transformation.
And it is. And it's scary.
Yeah.
Not just because I'm afraid of losing it, but because I always had this idea that I had to suffer.
Yeah.
Always, since I was a kid, that, you know, if you don't suffer enough, you're not worthy.
Right.
You need to struggle. Life must be struggle.
Yeah.
Not always, you know?
I know. And what if it's true, because I relate to that a lot, not only not always, but not. I mean, because, you know, they say, you know, pain is necessary, suffering is optional.
Yeah. Oh, yeah.
And, you know, ideally we learn in recovery how to, you know, experience these things. You know, there's Dino Carrie White.
No.
Previous podcast guest. She's amazing. She's been sober forever. And she used to, oh God, she used to say this thing about like being in bad weather. It's all about just like having the right slicker.
Yeah.
Like if you're in the rain, you just, all you need is an umbrella. And ideally, you know, recovery gives us that emotional umbrella. Do you know what I mean?
Oh yeah, absolutely. And that's to me the real shift in perception in sobriety has been when I stopped playing with my pain because I used it.
Yeah.
For a long time.
Yeah.
It was kind of another drug for me.
Right. How?
The being a victim.
Mm-hmm.
The passive aggressive being victim, you know. I used it as a weapon.
Well, so what do you mean? How would you be passive aggressive?
Oh, you know, I'm learning how to tell people what I feel, what I need, what I like, and what I don't like. So in all my previous relationships, not necessarily romantic relationship, but, you know, work relationship with my family, with my friends, my game was blaming, was doing everything people wanted me to do.
Mm-hmm.
Because I've always been afraid of being abandoned for some reason. I don't know why. I didn't have that kind of childhood where...
But, I mean, we can get that from a childhood that's not traumatic. You know, some tiny things parents did. I mean, who do you know who doesn't have abandoned?
That was my terror of being abandoned, of being... If I tell you, you know, I really don't like this, you're going to get rid of me.
Mm-hmm.
That's been my fear, my biggest fear. And so what happened is that I would never... tell the truth,
mm-hmm.
and then blame the other person for the outcome or mm-hmm. for things that... I remember after I read the book, I had to talk to an ex-boyfriend
mm-hmm.
just to let him know that the book is a novel, but there's something autobiographical. And
yeah.
I wanted to just make sure that it was fine with a story in the book. And he told me that he had no idea. You know, it was a very damaging relationship, both alcoholics. But for the first time, he told me, Alice, you never told me.
You never told me what?
You know, something very, it was a very traumatic sexual experience that I did completely fucked up. And then it took years for me to recover from.
And he had no idea that it was a disturbing experience for you?
Because I never showed, you know, I never
told him,
mm-hmm. but I blamed him silently.
Mm-hmm.
And I wrote a book about, I mean, not a book about it, but a huge, you know, it's a huge part in that story.
Mm-hmm.
And I kept hurting myself for what I did that night.
Mm-hmm.
I kept feeling guilty and ashamed for what
Are you willing night. To talk about what it was? Is it? It's in the book.
It's in the book. Actually, I even wrote about it. Yeah, it's... And, you know, that's the I said that whenever I think that I haven't reached the bottom...
Right.
And I have to go back to that night too.
Mm.
You know, it was... We were both drunk, and you know, in Italy there's a very open sexuality.
Yeah.
We're, you know, making out in front of everybody, but that night went a little bit, you know, kind of crossed the line.
Mm-hmm.
And I wanted more coke. And I didn't
mm-hmm.
have money.
Mm-hmm.
So his deal was to you know, just, you have sex with a dealer,
right?
And
we'll get coke.
I'm gonna take photos.
Okay.
So that's the story. And
why photos? And
he liked it.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
And you know, I hated it. I didn't want to do it, but I was so fucked up and desperate.
Yeah.
The crazy thing is that we drove through that part of town, and the first guy, you know, approached us, and of course he said yes.
What do you mean? How did it work?
Basically, we were driving in this, you know, downtown Turin where I lived at that time.
Yeah.
And we stopped a car
mm-hmm.
where the dealer was on, you know, it was just...
You knew the dealer or he was...
No,
you just knew.
Yeah. He was just there. In that part of town, you kind of recognize them. And he, my boyfriend at that time, you know, he
approached
just offered
him.
A deal, you know.
In front of you?
You have sex with her and you give her a call for free.
Right.
And he said yes.
Wow.
And I will never forget that he touched my leg through the open window.
Yeah.
And I realized that I couldn't do it for drugs.
Right.
So I drank more, and that's what I
wow.
did it for love. But But I did it anyway.
Yeah.
We went in a park. There's this crazy... I don't know how much...
It's the most interesting thing I've ever heard. So
it's comfortable. And, you know, right now, I never talked about this until I really got rid of the shame and realized that was my past. I don't care. You know, it's not who I am anymore.
Yeah.
It's something called dogging.
What is that?
Basically, you go into an open space at a park.
Uh-huh.
And... couples go there.
Yeah.
Other men know what happens in that park. So you park, and basically there are codes. If you just turn on the light, they come out of bushes and, you know,
watch.
They can watch. They can have sex with you. It's all according to the rules. So if you just turn on the light, they can just watch. If you turn down the window,
roll
down the window, and they can participate. So you choose your man.
Uh-huh.
The guy you want to, you know, and so we choose a guy.
Uh-huh.
Honestly, probably like 50 guys came out the moment we parked.
Is this always for drugs?
No, this is a sexual thing. I think it was a British thing, actually.
Okay.
But it's pretty big in Italy. There are places where this happens. So you park and men are there waiting.
But I wouldn't...
For a couple.
But why would women do it if not for an ulterior motive? I mean, I know...
Some women like it.
I know, for the most part.
Oh, yeah, exactly. And I was terrified of losing him. That's the point.
Yeah.
So I had sex with this guy in front of him.
Mm-hmm. In the car.
It was freezing. No, we're in a...
In the park.
Yeah, there was a bench. And
okay, yeah.
It was freezing. It was winter. No, touring up in the Alps. It's snow. So I remember snow. And I remember everything, actually.
Yeah.
And I didn't want to lose him. I thought that I'd say no. And that's been, you know, always my fear.
Just like you were talking about,
and that's why I would get high. And that's why I would drink. Because... It allowed me to do whatever they wanted me to do.
Yeah. Did it only happen once?
That thing happened once, yeah.
And so at the time you get the Coke.
And I hated myself.
Yeah, when you got the Coke, you know, if you're in the wrong frame of mind, the Coke high is pretty shitty.
And even the drunk, you know.
Yeah.
And the morning I already hated my body for all the reasons that I write about.
Yeah.
But, I hated myself for doing that. And I hated myself for never telling him, you know, no, I don't want to do this.
Right.
I did a bunch of stuff that I didn't want to do.
Right. It's interesting that he had no idea. I mean, I get it that you didn't tell him, but still.
Well, you know, I did it. He never.
Yeah. Yeah.
That's something that helped my denial in understanding that I had a problem. Because I was with people. Like, I didn't have normal friends, or call it normal, whatever you can consider normal.
Yeah.
But so for me, that was the routine.
Yeah. To do stuff you didn't want to do, to hate yourself for it.
And to have power. I always felt like I wasn't enough.
Yeah.
And I was fat and ugly, and I wasn't enough.
Was that true?
I didn't have a voice. Well, yeah. I had, you know, when my bulimia started, I was...
You were overweight.
I was a little overweight, yeah.
Because we all have body dysmorphia. Okay, so you were legitimately overweight.
Oh, yeah.
Okay, so wait, let's go back further. So you were born... Do you have siblings?
I have a brother, a very normal brother.
A very normal brother. Is he older?
He's a younger, 2 years younger.
Okay, so you're the first child in this Italian family. Your parents are still married?
Uh-huh.
And do they have... is there addiction in your family?
No, there's a lot of depression in my family.
Mm-hmm.
My grandmother, and I always wanted to be like her. I knew that I was like her, and but that runs in the family. Like I said, you know, real.
Have people committed suicide in your family?
She tried,
mm-hmm.
And you know, it was those years when whatever she did, she would be locked up and have electroshock. So that was her entire life. And we had a special connection.
My grandmother had that same situation.
So that's what they did, you know, back then.
Yeah.
That was the lock you up and fry your brain.
Why did you want to be like her?
I felt a connection with her.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
I knew that the way she suffered was familiar to me.
Even though you were just a child.
Oh, I was a very... Something changed for me, like, quite early.
Mm-hmm.
I don't know when, but I remember crying. Like I remember every Christmas night, I would end up in my bedroom crying. There was this too deep of a feeling for whatever was
happening. Yeah,
was happening, and I never felt part of what was going on?
Mm-hmm.
And this was really, this started really when I was very, very young.
And did, were your parents aware of that?
No. I lied a lot.
Mm-hmm.
I had this,
yeah.
I was like, I wanted to be the perfect daughter.
It's interesting that in light of what I was saying about how open you were about being depressed and how open you are about being happy today as an adult.
But you know, even back then, I will never forget that I never had to, my parents, I was a very smart kid. My brother had more problems, like, not problems, I mean, he's super smart. He's actually living in Germany and studying kind of medicine in German. So,
mm-hmm.
But at that time, he needed more attention from my parents. I didn't.
Mm-hmm.
So I was always the grown-up one. Mm-hmm. I was always allowed to do everything.
Mm-hmm.
They never said no to me.
Mm-hmm.
Never had to lie about cigarettes.
Mm-hmm.
Once I discovered my eating disorder, which was very severe at that time. You know, I went to hospitals, and I will never forget that one day I was supposed to be hospitalized.
You're supposed to what?
Be hospitalized in a clinic.
Uh-huh, hospitalized, yeah.
Yeah, I'm sorry. That's why you have to edit all my articles.
Yeah. Look, you don't know what trouble if I tried to write in Italian, yeah.
And I remember we went there, and after the visit with the first visit with the doctor, I told them, you know what? I don't need this. I'm gonna recover by myself. And they believed me.
Well, yeah, but I mean, a lot of people are terribly ignorant about how that works.
And
if they have no experience.
They were in every aspect of this of my damaging and ignorant in a good way, like
yeah.
really like not knowing. They lived in denial.
Yeah,
and they saw me, but they just thought that I was
So when did you first drink, and when did you first do drugs?
Well, drink pretty early. I don't remember the age because, you know, in Italy we don't have a limit, and that's
mm-hmm.
in high school.
Mm-hmm.
I was not necessarily early. Sometimes I hear people 12 years old.
Yeah.
Now. I would try wine because my grandpa would make wine.
Yeah.
But it was never. One thing that I remember both with drinking and cocaine, which was my main thing. Cocaine and Xanax were my
mm-hmm.
were my. Thing it was never to have my fun part really lasted
mm-hmm.
a very short period of time. I one of my first the first time I got drunk, I liked it so much that my only worry was, what about tomorrow?
Yeah. So what was that first time? Do you remember the first time that you did coke?
Oh yeah. And that's the
how old were you?
How old was I? 18, 19?
Mm-hmm. And what were the circumstances? Somebody just brought it out?
With a former boyfriend.
Mm-hmm.
And
not that same one.
No. And he made me feel beautiful.
Mm-hmm.
He made me feel beautiful. He gave me the... I was okay naked.
Mm-hmm.
And I felt powerful.
Mm-hmm.
I felt powerful with a man.
Mm-hmm.
My first boyfriend was a heroin addict. Mm-hmm. I was 16 and he was 32.
Wow. So you've always liked older men.
Yeah. I think I don't know. But at that time, I was kind of sick. Like,
are you very close to your dad? Is like, you know, my mom always loved older men. She had a super close relationship.
I had a
love-hate
relationship with my dad. I'm starting now to...
Mm-hmm.
I don't know what happened. We always fought a lot. We're very similar.
Mm-hmm.
And in my family, there was this recurrent thing, like both my mother and my brother, you are just like your father.
Right.
And it was this anger issue, food issue. That's where the food issue comes from. And there's a part of me that never wanted to be like my father.
Right.
And now, I'm starting now to recover the relationship with him.
Mm-hmm.
We're far away, so it's probably that's why.
It's easier. You know, I had the same thing. I mean...
And I have guilt, you know, about that, because I always said, why I'm not able to say I love you to my parents, or to my father especially. Why I'm not able to hug my father? It gave me a huge amount of guilt.
Mm-hmm. What I was saying... So I was just saying, I had a similar thing with my dad, with them telling me that I was just like my dad, but
Yeah, and put, you know, and it really gives you that idea, first of all, what's wrong.
Mm-hmm.
Besides, yeah, the anger issue, it's pretty big in my family.
Mm-hmm.
I grew up with the fear of, if I do this, and there was never violence in my family. It was verbal.
Mm-hmm.
But I grew up with the idea of, if I do this wrong, you're going to get mad.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
And, you know, I have this thing now. I have this thing now with a, you know, with a boyfriend.
Mm-hmm.
And it's usually related to men. Like, oh my God, if I do this wrong, he's going to get pissed.
And you have that with your relationship now?
Yeah.
Uh-huh.
And it's in my, I know that it's in my head.
Uh-huh.
I know that a fight is not necessarily what is going to happen.
Yeah.
In my family, there were a fight.
Mm-hmm.
It was a constant fight.
Mm-hmm. Go on.
No, and, you know, it's really hard to get rid of those old ideas.
Uh-huh. And so, did you ever do heroin, by the way?
And yeah, but here in the United, oddly enough, not with the...
The junkie boyfriend.
Yeah, because he was kind of in recovery. It was one of those recoveries where he was allowed to drink and smoke weed, but he just had to quit dope.
What kind of recovery is that?
You know that I will never forget, his first gift was a wooden pipe.
Mm-hmm.
To smoke weed that he carved in rehab.
His first gift?
I think it's still in my parents' house. But his Valentine's mm-hmm. gift.
Mm-hmm.
There was a flower and this wooden pipe to mm-hmm. smoke weed.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, he was in recovery, but it's not in the program. The thing is that I never wanted to become like him.
Mm-hmm.
Because I was 16 and I saw what drugs did mm-hmm. to you.
Mm-hmm.
So I decided that food was the right thing for me, and that would damage myself with food.
And so were you always overweight as a kid?
Mm-hmm. Yeah. I mean, I would say from elementary school.
Mm-hmm.
I had no control.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, I got introduced to
bulimia. And how long were you bulimic?
Since that day, and you know, it's been a year now.
A year that
without throwing up, and because in recovery, you know, when I quit drugs, I gained so much weight.
Mm-hmm.
And you know, for me, it was always a matter of fluctuating, like it was a fluctuating weight and mm-hmm. you know, starvation and, mm-hmm. and binging.
Mm-hmm. And how often were you doing it when it was bad?
Oh. I got down to like 10 times a day. I would stick up, you know, stuff in the trash. That was my... It was a constant filling up and emptying, filling up. And then, you know, I think I kind of discovered this high of,
yeah.
of when you binge and then the purification process. But I ruined my stomach. I ended up bleeding. That's when the first time I realized that I had a problem.
So what happened?
I would, you know, throw up blood.
Uh-huh. And then did you tell people and immediately get help?
No. My parents, I don't even know how they found out.
Well, they took you to that hospital.
They took me to a hospital. We went, you know, around to look for the right hospital. And I told, you know, when we were there in Florence, it was this beautiful hospital with pine trees. And I told them, I don't want to be here. And the reason why I didn't want to be there is because I didn't want to gain weight.
Mm-hmm.
So I thought that I could have things under control, and that's what I've been doing, you know, with food, with alcohol, with drugs. I just didn't know who I was without all this stuff.
And did you go into a program for the food stuff?
No.
You've just been able to stop?
Yeah, when I got sober the second time, because I got sober the first time and then I relapsed.
Mm-hmm.
I relapsed after 7 months.
Mm-hmm.
The second time, I got so desperate
mm-hmm.
and so sad
mm-hmm.
that I was really ill. And not even right away, actually.
Mm-hmm.
It took me almost 9 months.
Mm-hmm.
And my second, and as of today, last sobriety
mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
to really say, okay, this is enough.
Mm-hmm.
Because when I got sober, I continued, you know, throwing up and cutting myself.
Uh-huh. When did you first start cutting yourself?
It was a little bit after the eating disorder. I was probably 20.
Mm-hmm. And so you did heroin later, you said, once you
very
got
late
here.
Very late here in L.A., yeah.
Did you just snort it or?
No, I
you shot it. Okay, was that
I
a big deal?
I never snorted it.
Yeah.
I think smoked it once. But I never got it. You know, I was lucky enough to discover that at the very... I like coke. That was really my thing. And one of my dealer one day had it, and I wanted to try heroin.
So he just goes, well, I've got coke, but I've also got heroin.
And I liked it. I liked it a lot.
Did you shoot up at your dealer's
house? Yeah, everything.
He did it for you?
And then I did it. It was always a solitary thing for me.
Yeah.
But even coke, you know, I was never a party girl.
Yeah.
I had a very short party girl
time. Yeah.
I was working in a club. I was with this boyfriend in Italy. But when I came here, it was, I ended up locked in a room and hallucinating and switching from coke to Xanax. And
I think that's the story for a lot of us.
I was in fear of even walking out, you know, to get milk.
Yeah.
I was terrified of walking. I always had this thing of, I don't fit in the world, and I feel uncomfortable. So I would get high and try to do a couple of things that I had to do. But then I ended up being so scared, you know, so paranoid.
Yeah.
Paranoid of being caught. And you know, I didn't even have... I wasn't an American. I didn't have a visa.
Right.
So what
right.
they do, they send you back there.
Right. Wait, hang on one second. So what were you saying? You were talking about... doing heroin, Xanax, and cocaine. So you were home alone doing cocaine and hallucinating and switching off with cocaine and Xanax.
Yeah. And alcohol.
Uh-huh.
I would drink. I was drunk.
Uh-huh. How many times did you get heroin from that dealer?
Six?
Mm-hmm.
Five?
Mm-hmm.
It was the very bottom, the very, very end.
And so then you found recovery.
I found recovery.
Uh-huh.
I didn't have any idea what this was.
Uh-huh.
Because it's not big in Italy.
Yeah.
I mean, not that I knew of.
Yeah.
And if my former roommate at that time, because I collapsed one night.
Uh-huh.
I don't remember if she found me or woke up. I mixed wrong stuff. I mixed pills and coke and drank and Xanax. Because then, when I moved to the United States, I discovered pills.
Yes.
And I just collapsed.
So it was the Xanax. I mean, it's hard to collapse on cocaine unless you have a heart attack. So it was the Xanax that...
It was the mix.
And alcohol.
It was the mix.
Oh, really?
Oh, yeah. Because I had Oxycontin, I had cocaine, and
Oxycontin will do
and
it.
Drink, and Xanax.
Yeah. And so she just found you...
I don't remember if she or I woke up. Like, she was in Vegas.
Uh-huh.
And that following day, she asked me to go to make a phone call. So, you know, probably you have a problem.
Mm-hmm.
And I made the phone call to NA first. And I remember that I stopped drugs, but I kept drinking. And that's when my drinking really escalated.
Yeah.
Because that's every time that I would try to quit coke. I would drink more and more and more and more. And after 6 months, seven, I don't remember, in NA I relapsed. Something didn't go my way.
Yeah. Okay. Wait. So in NA, you were drinking.
Oh yeah, for a while, and then you know my sponsor there told me, you know, Alice, this is not
recommended. Yeah. What's funny is when I was like 3 or 4 years sober, I remember I was answering phones at central office with this guy, and I said, can you drink in NA or CA? I didn't know because I'd never been, and he goes, I don't know why he said that. And I called my sponsor and I said, you know what, I've been thinking about it. And, you know, I'm not an alcoholic. I mean, I was like 4 years sober or something. And she's like, well, you can't drink in NA and CA. So let go of that idea.
Yeah. And they say that in the program.
Of course.
Alcohol is a...
Of course.
But, you know, that was my denial.
Yeah.
I don't have a problem with alcohol.
And so then did you go to the other program?
Yes.
It
just didn't work, my relapse. I mean, it lasted for a month. I wasn't out for long. I hated it, though. It didn't work. I couldn't get drunk. I swallowed, and I had a bottle of pills. And I hated it.
You had a bottle of pills, meaning you took a bottle of pills, or?
A friend had them extra, and I got a bottle of Oxycontin.
And
I was Norco probably, but you know, that's what it was.
Sorry, you took it all at once, or you mean you were
Yeah.
And then you got into real recovery, or not that it wasn't real before, but you got sober.
Yeah.
And how did your life change? Was it very difficult at first? I mean, you mentioned relapsing at 7 months, I think.
No, because it was so that relapse was so awful.
Yeah. What was it like before the relapse?
What do you mean during the?
Oh, okay, I see. So you went to NA. I try not to say the names, but it is interesting. No. It is. I try. I do. But and it's interesting. I was just reading the reviews of this podcast, and somebody said, somebody I love said how good it was, and he said he was in NA, and all my guests are AA, but he gets it, and uh-huh. I thought that was really interesting because it never occurred to me. One of my interns who was writing for me, Erica Larson. I don't know if you know her by name.
Yeah,
she was NA.
Okay,
and she wrote about it. I just suddenly worried. So then you relapsed, and then you went to AA.
Yeah, you know what? During the relapse, I think I had something. The seed was planted in my head. I think. So I would every time I drink, it was with guilt. Mm-hmm. Like I knew that that I wasn't supposed to do that.
Mm-hmm.
Before that, I didn't care.
Yeah.
I wanted to die. That's what I wanted to do. I wanted to die, and I wouldn't die. So,
Were you actively suicidal?
I tried once when I was a teenager.
Mm-hmm. You wrists.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Not even a teenager. I was probably 20 in Italy.
And were you drunk? Were you high?
No, I was super sober. I wanted to die, and I didn't have the courage. I stopped.
Oh, wow. And did you stopped and did you have to go to get the wounds healed?
You know what happened? I lied. I thought I was about to go to camping that day.
Uh-huh.
I was camping with my two best friends.
Mm-hmm.
And I covered it up with I was a heavy metal girl, so mm-hmm. I had plenty of like leather bands.
Uh-huh.
So I covered with that and it got infected.
Ouch. Okay.
And I had to get stitches at the doctor at the camping because we were leaving the day after. So I arrived there with this infected wound, so they had to reopen it.
Uh-huh.
And the only person who kind of knew was my best friend, and the other girl who was with us, I kept saying that I cut myself with a tuna can. I will never forget the tuna can thing. Like, I open it.
And did you tell your best friend the truth?
Yeah.
Excuse me.
Yeah, and she knew.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. And, okay, but back to somewhat present day. So, wait, how long are you sober now?
Three months.
It's hard to do the math. Why? I know,
two
I always
years,
round
two,
up,
two,
you know?
Don't you say 2 years and some change?
I think people will say that. People say all kinds of things. What was it like learning the lingo in recovery as a second language?
It's really hard. Sometimes the prayers are hard for me because I know all the Italian versions.
Oh, you do?
Yeah.
I have this memory of when I was in Paris, and by the way, the cocaine, I don't know if it was throughout Europe, but in Paris, it was so good. Holy crap. And I was sort of with this heroin addict, for the month I was there. And I remember one night just being fucked up and writing, the serenity prayer. My French is really bad, but I could write the serenity prayer.
It must be so beautiful in French.
I can't remember, but it was like, I only knew it from the Sinead O'Connor song. Uh-huh. Like I didn't know it from anything else, but okay. So the prayers are kind of hard.
Yeah. The prayers and yeah, even the lingo. It's,
well, the lingo is so weird sometimes that I would imagine that would be really strange.
But you know, I didn't know the Italian one. So I kind of learn from scratch, and mm-hmm. sharing sometimes is hard.
Yeah.
Because I'm very conscious of the Italian.
Yeah.
And I know that I shouldn't worry. It's recovery. You know, you're just sharing a message, actually.
Yeah.
But I'm very conscious of...
And we don't have a lot of Italians out here doing that.
No.
I don't know any.
I don't think so.
Yeah.
You know, Italians are really... When I go there, they still ask me, can you just drink a glass of wine?
Yeah.
They still have this...
Have you been to meetings there?
I've been to meetings once.
Mm-hmm.
It's so different.
Yeah. Yeah.
And that day I was kind of the star of the meeting. They wanted to know everything about America. So the meeting lasted like 2 hours because for an hour I had to talk about AA.
Yeah.
In America.
And that's not really like having a meeting. That's getting to
but
do
you know,
an interview.
People there sometimes have one meeting a week.
Yeah.
And it's for the whole region. So people travel like 2 or 3 hours to get to that meeting. It's impressive.
I've been to meetings in London and then that were just depressing. I mean, there were, you know, and then when
What do you mean by depressing?
Oh, I mean like dark men in, not dark men, you know, dark weather. Just like, you know, those like gray sweaters and, you know, black coats and just, you know, but they didn't say it like that. You know, I want to die on a regular basis, you know, or whatever. It was just depressing. But when I was in Spain for a month, they had, I guess, two English-speaking meetings a week. And it was like four of us would go. And one of them I saw drinking, like, later that day. And he's like, hey, hey. Like, he didn't even think it was weird. And then another was like a crazy old man, and he talked about how he smoked pot. So I don't know. It was different. But I'm surprised there aren't more in Italy.
At least where I'm from, up, yeah. You know, I'm sure that in Rome,
yeah,
there are more. In Milan, there are more. Where I'm from, probably it's still.
And but you just joined right in. I mean, you started making friends. You started to get to know people.
I got a coffee commitment right away.
Uh-huh.
And that changed. You know, I was forced to be there.
Yeah.
And I got it for a year. And that really helped. It's the last thing I wanted to do. I'm shy. I'm very shy in real life, so I don't.
But are you? I mean, you're a real go-getter with the podcast and who you interview. I mean, is that shy?
You know, that's my. That's what I call my revenge. Like, I want to achieve something, and I really work hard to achieve that. But in a regular life, I'm shy to go to a grocery. I rarely look up to you at the grocery store.
Oh, really? Yeah. Really?
I'm that kind of shy.
Is it hard for you to reach out to people that you admire and you want to have as guests on your podcast, or do you just sort of barrel through that?
That comes kind of easy for me. I don't know why.
Yeah.
When it comes to work.
Yeah. You're more fearless.
Yeah. Because I feel like a, you know, I've been feeling like a fuck up all my life.
Yeah.
That I want to prove that I can do something good.
Yeah. Yeah. Do you feel like you have now? Or it's kind of drives you still?
No, it's not. It's not where I want to be.
Where do you want to be?
Well, like I want my. Well, the book is not out yet.
Yeah,
but I want to be recognized for what I do, and I'm not yet.
Yeah, it's a hard thing though, because especially if you're an alcoholic, like what does recognized mean?
Yeah,
many would say selling a book is having recognition, right?
Yeah, and you know the funny thing is that that kind of recognition and happiness for it lasted 2 days.
Yeah,
when I signed, you know, signed a contract. 2 days after, I was already okay. What now? What
that's so was my experience. I remember when my first book sold, my agent at the time was a real go-getter, and she said, you know, listen. I'm going to email, she said, tried to sell it at auction, you know, which is great because that just means they have to do it in a week. And she said, I'm going to send this out. I'm just going to tell them you're coming to New York next week. Only if we get bites are you coming to New York. And so two people said, you know, she sent it to five, and two said, yeah, we want to meet with her. And so, and then we went in there. So I just knew I was going to find out right away. And I remember I had dinner with friends in New York that night. And I said, if this happens, I'm going to be happy for the rest of my life. Like, because it was so heightened, to this just few days.
Yeah.
And I got the call, you know, that it was happening. And, yeah, I don't know. I mean, it definitely lasted the day.
Mm-hmm.
But I have no idea if it lasted longer. Because immediately I was like, well, I didn't get a two-book deal. I got to go sell a second book. And then you sell the second one and you just, you know.
And even the podcast for me is never enough because I'm like.
Why aren't there more downloads? I mean, I know.
That really affects your.
Your feeling about it. Yeah.
But at the same time, I go from this huge, you know, ego thing that I deserve more.
Yeah.
Why don't they see me?
Yeah.
To feeling like the worst, you know.
Well, yeah.
That's the other side of the.
My old therapist used to say, you're either the shit or shit. Like, you got to figure out the in between.
Yeah.
And it's really hard. Have I?
Uh-huh.
No.
Really in between?
I mean, more and more, you know, for a long, long, long time with the books, because I killed myself. You know, I did six. And my advances got worse on every single one. You know, it was sort of like recovery. Like, it started off really good, and then it dipped to halfway, then it went way up again, and then it dipped, and the last one, it was a joke, what I got. And And so it's impossible for me not to be affected by that. People say, you know, and especially on your second book, you're going, you've got the mean Amazon critics in your head. You've got all the, I hated your protagonist. Like, it never occurred to me that people were going to hate my protagonist in my first book. And so that's all in your head. And I can never have a pure experience writing again, because that's in my head. It's you know, and
I understand that. Oh, yeah.
And so my point is that, no, I mean, my first book was supposed to be this huge success. It was sold to Judith Regan. I was paid a lot of money. I was going to be on the cover. And then Judith Regan was fired in like the biggest scandal to ever hit publishing. And my book ended up being released 3 months later under a fake imprint of HarperCollins Made Up. And it got tons of press, but they didn't print a lot. Uh-huh. And, you know, and there was no, forget a publicity department, there was no Regan Books anymore. And so I really had been told and had, you know, that I had a right to these expectations. And so when it wasn't a bestseller, and then I've been sort of digging out from those bad sales ever since, you know, my second book, my agent said, I think it'd be better if you went under a different name.
Wow.
Because you'd have a better shot as an unproven person than as someone whose book was you were paid money and you didn't earn out the advance. And so for years I've been like, how could I not get what I deserved? How could I? And then it occurred to me, I don't know, a year or two ago, what if I've gotten more than I deserve? What makes me so confident that I deserve so much? Yeah. What if there are hundreds of thousands of people smarter and more talented and harder working than me that have gotten not this?
But see, that's how, when you shift to the feeling guilty when you have something, you know, feeling guilty when I'm happy or when I get something, because I'm not sure I really deserve it.
Did you feel guilty when you sold the book?
No.
Yeah.
But I thought about, you know, I still don't know. Sometimes I still don't know why he said yes, because to me that book is, and I'm going through the final edits now. Sometimes they're like, why? Is he really a book? I still don't know whether it's a book or not. I'm still not 100%. I don't know how people, and now there's old fear. People are gonna hate it. People are not gonna like it.
Yeah.
My writing is not good enough.
Yeah. I mean, I think if it's sold, we can rest assured, and it's coming out, we can rest assured your writing is good enough, you know? It's funny because my second book, I hated when I sold it. I couldn't believe they made an offer.
Which one was it?
It's called Bought. You loved that one.
Oh, Bought was the second one.
Yeah. I hate that book so much. I can't even tell you. And so I said to them after we sold it, I'd like to do a page one rewrite. And they said, that's crazy. We love this book. And I rewrote the entire thing from scratch, and I still hated it. And I hated it when it was released, and I have a bad feeling about it still. So so I definitely thought on that it was not good enough to sell.
Yeah.
And I still think that. But who knows how much is alcohol. You know, it's hard to know what's real.
That's the thing. And, you know, sometimes I use that to justify everything.
Mm-hmm.
I'm an alcoholic. Well, you know, that's what people tell you in meetings. Like, but you're an alcoholic. So there's a justification for everything.
I know, which is fucked up. Because,
right?
And not everybody tells you that. You know, there are people who do lean on that as an excuse. And yet, I think a lot of it's real. I think our brains work differently. But once we're aware of that, isn't it our responsibility
to try to change? Yeah.
Yeah. You know, I just see it as like the volume is turned up really high. Everybody has insecurity. Everybody has fear. Alcoholics have it in a way that they feel like they can't tolerate it.
Yeah. It's like they're feeling too much.
Yeah.
You know, it's like they're being affected by everything that that happens.
Yeah. So, you know, those first few years, I mean, so this, like, this joy that you're in now, is this the first time you've been really happy in your life?
Yeah.
Wow.
Purely happy.
Yeah.
And unconditionally happy. Yeah. Yes.
I'm actually writing a story on how can I tell the difference between things going well and being spiritually aligned. Huh. You know, how do you make sure your happiness is not dependent on circumstances?
Wow. Oh, my God.
Right?
Now you make me doubt about it.
No, because it's so hard. It's impossible to tell the difference. And I have a lot more experience with happiness dependent on circumstances than happiness because I'm just so spiritually aligned. Do you know what I mean?
Yeah. This has a lot to do with circumstances. You know, I'm very well aware of that.
Right. But that doesn't mean it's not real.
Yeah, that's the thing.
At all. It's real.
As long as you know that it's going to evolve. Because I know that I'm not going to be and stay in the state of euphoria and fairy tale forever.
Yeah, yeah.
So it will evolve.
Yeah.
But, you know, my thing has always been, I want to get that high.
Yeah.
And then what happens when you,
I know,
when you crash?
What goes up must come down. I know. But is that as true? I mean, it was certainly true. Like, cocaine is the most, you know, direct, tangible example. But, you know, I do think that's what recovery is. We learn to temper those highs so that we can temper those lows.
Yeah. And accept and accept that there are highs and there are lows. I mean, that's life. And for everybody, not just for us.
Yeah.
I never accepted that. I always wanted to stay where I was, you know.
Yeah.
And I always thought that whether it was good or bad, I wanted the things to stay the same. Okay, this is how it's going to be. I want this to be forever.
Even the bad?
Oh, yeah.
That's so interesting.
Because I couldn't deal with the new fake illusion.
Why was it a fake illusion?
Well, because I would always get attached to, and that's, you know, that's a problem of attachment, which is something else, but if something good happens, I get attached to that emotion.
Yeah.
And then what happens with that emotion goes away.
Yeah. Yeah. It's, and so when did the giddiness and the happiness start? Like 2 or 3 months ago?
Yeah, 3 months ago.
And so you met a guy?
I met a guy.
Yeah.
We fell in love, really. I think that's the first time that I truly love.
And what happened? What was, so you had him on your podcast?
I don't know. It's kind of public. So yeah, I had him on my podcast, and I've been knowing him for a while.
Yeah.
But never, I don't know, something happened during the podcast.
Mm-hmm.
We clicked.
Mm-hmm. And afterwards, what happened? He said,
you know, after I was the one, because he's way older.
Yeah.
So he didn't want to use the podcast as a, you know. So after a week, I invited him for gelato, and we went to have gelato in Malibu, Italian gelato, and we've been together ever since.
Yeah, and so, did you have big discussions about what's the age difference? It's like 40 years.
No, 29.
29 years.
And I'm very careful to say 29, not 30.
Wow. Yeah. Yeah. My stepdad, my mom's like big love of her life was my stepdad, who's 18 years older.
29, I know, 29 is a lot.
Wow. Wow. And did you have doubts about that? Never. No. Never.
I thought of it once.
Yeah.
Not for the future, but then I'm like, why should I think about the future?
Right, right.
10 years from now.
Do you guys talk about the future?
Oh, yeah. It's kind of serious. I mean, it's...
Yeah.
It went very fast. Let's put it this way.
And so for a future, you could see yourself staying with somebody who's...
Oh, yeah.
29 years older?
Yeah.
Wow.
We play with the 1,000 years.
What do you mean?
We're going to stay together for 1,000 years.
It sounds like a song.
It's really, I want to be happy. He makes me happy.
Yeah.
And he's sober too. So that's very important for me.
Yeah.
I really needed that.
Yeah.
But
also, other things in your life are going very well as well.
Yeah.
You have the book coming out.
The podcast is, you know, it's very slow, but...
Yeah.
And I love work. You know, you know that, how much I love writing for After.
Yes, I know. And I love having you do it. It's you know, it's such a grind. I love the site. I love it so much. It's like my baby, but it is such a grind for me because I'm the only editor.
You should be so proud for that. I am.
I'm very lucky that somebody came along and bought it because I was really losing steam when I was building it on my own. And we're really gearing up. We're taking ads now, and we are increasing the content like tenfold. So it's kind of scary, but it's good. It's good.
See, think about this whenever you feel like you're not enough.
You know, I'm 13 years and 10 months sober.
Okay.
So the feeling like I'm not enough, that is one thing that has gotten so much better over the years.
What do you do to make it?
Unfortunately, the answer was live and experience and let time pass. And the important thing, I think, is, you know, I think a lot of alcoholics, we have a feeling, we don't want to feel lonely. We don't want to feel scared. Uh-huh. So instead, we make up a story that's much worse. Instead of I feel lonely, it's I'll be alone for the rest of my life. Instead of I feel scared, it's this is never going to work out. And so it took doing that enough times and realizing I was lying to myself. I still get fully triggered, but it's more like moving a phantom limb. I know that it's there and it feels real, but it's not that all-encompassing feeling.
How do you know that? Because sometimes I try to do that as an exercise.
Yeah.
But I still don't know whether I'm fooling myself with that idea.
Which one?
The, you know, the phantom limb. Like, it's there, but it's not necessarily true.
It's really hard. It's like having PMS. You know you're depressed because you have PMS.
That.
Oh, you don't? You don't get to experience that?
I think it's all... that's the thing. I always think it's me.
Yeah. Well, it's like I don't believe in allergies because I don't have any. But you know what I mean? If you don't experience it, there are people who don't believe in alcoholism because they don't experience it. Mm-hmm. I experience my moods shift, and it is not in my head. It's not really bad. I have friends who have PMS that's just brutal. But even though you know it's real, it doesn't mean it's not true.
Yeah.
So that's the problem with even the phantom limb, where you're like, I know this isn't true, and so it's just sort of waiting for it to pass, as opposed to really believing it and curling up in the small ball in your house and going, "This is never going to end." Crying,
which is another tool. It's another tool to deal with life.
I don't think it's a great tool. I mean, look,
no, call it a tool or a
necessary rite of passage. I don't know.
It's been mine for a long time in sobriety.
Yeah. Well, this girl that I used to go to meetings with used to say, you know, crying is watering the garden. You need to go through it. But I could have had a life. I think if I could have had less tears in my life so far, I would have taken it. Do you know what I mean?
See, for me, I understand your point. For me, it was always
necessary.
Only by doing this, I'm going to have this kind of absolution or.
Yeah. Yeah.
Ridiculous.
No, it's, you know, I don't think it is. I mean, it's sort of like you had to suffer for however long you were in that depression to experience this. You know, the whatever, the calm, you know, the calm before, what is, you know, it's always darkest before the dawn. It's true. It's true.
Yeah, my idea though was that, okay, I'm an alcoholic, so I have to be dark. I have to be, pay respect to that label that I.
Yeah.
Which is bullshit.
That is bullshit.
Because it doesn't help people.
No, no.
You know, if you can share something good and positive with people.
Because you're not doing much good in the world if you're telling people. Yeah. You know, if our whole goal with doing all of this work is to show people who are suffering from addiction what life can be like, people will be like, I don't want that. I'll keep doing what I'm doing.
And that's why I think you read something that I wrote. It's getting sober doesn't mean being miserable and frustrated.
Yeah.
That's been a lesson to learn and to accept, to just embrace.
Yeah.
That, you know, what they said at the beginning was true.
Yeah.
I always laughed at the fourth dimension.
Yeah, I know.
Because I go, that's bullshit.
Now you're in it.
It's not.
Yeah. Rocketed into the fourth dimension.
Yeah, and you know what? I'm very well aware that it's going to change.
Yeah, and I mean, it's like, you know, I will pet my cat who I adore so much, and then my next thought is, she's going to die and I'm not going to be okay. Like, really, can't I just experience petting a cat?
Yeah.
You know? Well, and so about your podcast, so it's called Coffee with Alice, and who have been some of your guests?
I had Moby, Bill Pullman, I had Mark Maron, I had Miss Anna David.
You did.
I had Ben Montench from Tom Petty and the Heartbreakers.
Oh, I've heard of him.
That's how we fell in love.
Yeah. Podcast.
And I'm going to have Kate Micucci next week. And
I know that name. Oh, from...
The one from Garfunkel Notes?
Wow.
She's fantastic.
And I think I reached out to her for this. Oh, because I was doing non-sober people. No. I went through this phase where I did, I think, 6 episodes of people who had just been through something.
Oh, okay.
But I went back to sober people.
Yeah, so it's...
Yeah. And Janet Fitch. Did you say that
one? I had Janet Fitch.
She's amazing.
Fantastic.
Yeah.
And I'm going to have Danielle Stewart.
Oh, great.
In 3 weeks, I think.
Oh, I didn't know that. Yeah, she's amazing.
Yeah.
She's...
I have Patrick O'Neill, who writes for...
I listened to that episode.
It's a beautiful interview.
Yeah. I want to have him on this. I haven't talked to him about it.
It's a great interview.
Yeah. Yeah, yes. Yeah. Bank robber. Yes. Well, listen, Alice, this has been fantastic. Is there anything else you want to tell listeners?
Thank you.
I'm so glad you did this. If you guys have not seen Alice's stuff on the site, I hope you'll go and read it and listen to her podcast and everything else. Okay.
Thanks for having me.
Yep. We've gone international. That was Alice Carbone. So self-conscious about how I say her name. Anyway, the host of Coffee with Alice, the popular podcast, the writer for After Party Chat, and the novelist with a debut novel coming out in May of 2015. Thank you for listening. See you next week.